Hi, this is the Morbid Anatomy Transmission, and I'm your host, Molly McBride Jacobson. My guest today is Andy Harriman, author, DJ, music anthropologist, and studier of all things goth. Specifically, Andy looks at 1980s goth culture, why it happened, why it was important, and how it manifested itself. She recently spoke on this, The Morbid Anatomy, in a lecture entitled A Desire for Dramaticism. There will be a repeat of this event on June 23rd, but unfortunately, that one has already sold out. Keep your eyes peeled, and maybe you can snag some extra tickets. Now, bust out those Bauhaus records and stay tuned to learn more about Andy and all of her work.
Hey, I'm Andy Harriman. I'm an author, first and foremost. I'm also a DJ, and I run a few events. But I just wrote the book Somewhere Leather, Somewhere Lace, and it's about the 80s goth subculture.
Does goth as we know it start in the 80s? Or
goth as we know it?
Yeah.
Goth is a very vague term for a lot of different movements, I think. In my research, I've interviewed about 100 different goths around the world. Some of them didn't even call themselves goths because it was before the term was actually used for the movement, which is why in the book we called it post-punk.
Mm.
So it was right after post-punk when a darker movement came about. So I think it started in the late 70s, the dark movement. And through my research, I think that goth ended about 1992, maybe mid-90s. I know a lot of people might disagree with that, but from my research, I feel that 14 years was very, a scene grew and a scene died.
So you don't think that it's as it was in the 80s in existence?
Not at all.
Anymore? Yeah. Like, where did it start? Where did it come from? Is it located in a city or any place, or did it sort of spring up all over the place?
No, I think, magically, through my research as well, I found out that the scene was growing all around the world. Punk had become an international movement. So naturally, everything just got a bit darker all around the world. I think central locations would be in the UK. I think a lot of the visuals started there, but it was actually a worldwide movement.
It seems like sort of a little emblem of its time period, almost. Mm-hmm. So what do you think the conditions were in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s for the doom and gloom side of punk to spring up into goth?
Well, punk was very angry and also very simplistic in its music. I mean, I love punk, but I can understand why people would want something a little bit more meaningful and beefy. Not everybody was angry.
Mm-hmm.
And goths are pretty peaceful, actually. A lot of them just wanted to express themselves but not be angry at anything. And a lot of people were apolitical, which is what punks were not, basically. So they were more about being in a nurturing scene rather than going against any one sort of political movement.
It does seem like the goth movement had more to do with art and you know, art in all forms. And it you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of it is that it related a lot to like romanticism of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate?
Well, I think goths did derive a lot of inspiration from like Queen Victoria and the way she wore black all the time,
mm-hmm.
obviously, from mourning. But then there were also the Gothic novels.
Right, exactly.
In the 1700s and early 1800s, like Edgar Allan Poe. Yeah, and Frankenstein, Dracula, of course. And then that went into the visuals of the early film, like Dracula with Bela Lugosi,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. So they were very well-read, and they had seen a lot of movies as well.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, cause I just listened to a podcast on Bela Lugosi, actually, and it's funny because, I think of that movie as, like, iconic and just, like, you know, a sort of major turning point, but it kind of wasn't at the time. It was sort of like a B movie.
Right.
Which is interesting that people in the 80s and still are accessing these parts of culture that were, mm-hmm. you know, sort of not representative of the whole, not sort of what everybody was right. hailing as
well, I think
high
what,
culture.
What people like about those movies and about those books and about goth in general is that it is scary and a little bit mysterious, but it's also very romantic.
Mm-hmm.
People are drawn to that sort of thing, which is why vampires are
yeah.
are out of control right now. Everybody loves a vampire
yeah.
for those two reasons.
Yeah, and I think it also is sort of accessing common emotions that everybody feels. Mm-hmm. You know, so when, I don't remember when Dracula came out, but at that point in time.
1930.
Yeah, so, yeah. like, goth was even more out of place in right. 1931 than it was in the 80s.
Right.
In terms of, like, gothic architecture and art, mm-hmm. does goth relate to that? And that's probably where it derives its name from that.
It
right?
relates to the gothic literature. Gothic literature is called that because of the gothic castles that these books were set in,
mm-hmm.
but Gothic was termed by first in the 1960s for the Doors because they were kind of very theatrical, like these
oh,
Gothic
interesting.
Novels. And then 10 years later, Joy Division was called Gothic. So then it just evolved from there.
Which is funny because I don't think of those bands as Gothic at
right.
all. Which
right. I mean, the Doors, I mean, the Goths in the late 80s did derive back to the sort of guitar, mm-hmm. psychedelic look and wanted to get back to the guitar sound that the Doors had. And, I mean, they were very dark for the time, and Jim Morrison was definitely theatrical, like Peter Murphy would be or somebody like mm-hmm. that.
You touched a little bit on this, but what do you think the impulse is to unify a group of people, or for a group of people to unify themselves underneath the umbrella of sort of dark aesthetics and, I don't want to say sadness, but sort of doom and gloom.
I think people are drawn, like I said, they're drawn to something mysterious while it still being romantic, and I think people do like the dark side. Especially the music is so powerful, and when it hits that person, I don't think you can actually choose to be goth. I think it chooses you
mm.
because you're interested in that music and it draws you in, and then the visuals are so close to that music, you just want to look the part, you know.
You're a music anthropologist, mm. right? And goth is really oriented around the music,
right.
it seems like. Well, so do you think the subculture preceded the music, or do you think the music preceded the subculture?
I think...
Or did they arise in
time? Well, I think they definitely go hand in hand. I don't think you can have goth without the music. And I think the early... There was a lot of punk crossover in terms of the goth style, so I think it just kind of grew from being... goths took from the New Romantics, from punks, from glam, and they just kind of made it their own and put their own dark, their own little dark pieces to it. But I think that the music was so dark and atmospheric, it just, you have to wear black. It's like, but I mean, also goths were very bright as well. They wore, you know, glam makeup and colors weren't that odd.
Yeah.
Goths, because they would dye their hair. I mean, goths still dye their hair today. Black is synonymous with goth, but you don't have to wear black to be a goth. In the 80s, the hair was big, the makeup was a certain way, and it was because of the icons like Susie Sue and Robert Smith, because different forms of media was very traditional, like just through print and through TV, so it was very limited in their inspirations. Which is why they were able to create their own little world.
Right, and rile against the mainstream,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Which is different nowadays because of the internet. And that's what I say in my book. I say, you know, when the internet started, you don't really have to have that much creativity anymore because you can pull from whatever you want. And back in the 80s, they didn't have that.
That's really interesting. I never mm-hmm. thought about that. We talked about a minute ago that goth has really divided into like 1,000, mm-hmm. maybe even more, different subcultures,
right.
which is one interesting to me because, you know, like you said, it goth as it was in the 80s doesn't really exist anymore.
Mm.
And two, because I can't think of any other subculture that still, you know, is unified under the umbrella of goth, whether or not that's a real thing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And yet has all these different things. Like, you know, you can think of emo came out of that, and like cyber goths,
right,
and steampunk a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you think that goth was so prolific?
Well, I think what was special about goth, and it's often overlooked, which is why I wrote my book, and because punk has been talked about so many times, like so many different types, so many different subcultures have been covered, but for some reason goth hasn't, and it's had like the longest lifespan of any sort of subculture, especially in the 80s. What was special about the 80s goths is that they were able to have this club, culture, much like, you know, the New Romantics did, but the New Romantics only lasted like 1 or 2 years, really. And goth was able to have their clubs, and I call it their home, where they felt safe. And I think that translated into modern times. Like, goths still love to meet up in these clubs or spaces to have their own private parties. And I think that's one of the reasons why goth is still around today. Like, punks really didn't have that. They had venues to go see, like CBGBs, of course, but nothing was ever really recreated like that. But goths have kind of formed into this, to so many different places. But I think that's what's special about goth, because you can have cyber goth parties, but then you can have steampunk parties. Anybody can dress the way they want to, but they can still listen to that goth music, which is nice.
And I think it clearly is serving a market, but very different markets. So, like, if you, you know, for some reason, the only two ones that are coming to mind are steampunk and cybergoth.
Yeah.
Two very different communities that have some overlap, but are really
they
unified.
Do have a little bit of
different aesthetics and fantasies.
What I think is great about the mid-80s is that that's when goth really came to life, and there were no sub-genres of goth. And that's when the best music was made. That's when everybody was rising to fame. It was right before mainstream success. That's when goth really was important and special. And then, you know, in the late 80s, they broke off to gothic rock and then into industrial. And that's when the scene just started splitting, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Right, it just happens.
That's why I don't think goth is from the 80s exists anymore, because nobody's really working together to bring it all back together, because everybody has their own communities. There's no need to.
Yeah.
And plus, you have the internet, you can shuffle around to whatever you want anyway. The 80s were special. 80s were a special time for goths, more than any other subculture, I think.
I sort of think of them as defining of that era.
Right.
So who calls themselves goths today, then?
A lot of people would. That's what I have a little bit of trouble with. I don't really think subcultures exist anymore.
How do you mean?
Subcultures in the way that people needed each other to be a community, because everybody has an online community, and everybody, you can call them tribes or a lot. There's a lot of different ways you can call these people. I like to call them communities. So goth in the term of subculture does not exist anymore, because you have the internet and everybody can pick and choose how they want to look. You're not just, it's more about the individual now instead of the group, because everybody wants to be themselves instead of being a goth. You're yourself now, which is because of the internet, I think. And I think everybody wants to identify just, they want to be a part of a community, but they don't want to be like everyone else. They want to be able to choose what they want to be inspired by. I mean, I know people disagree with that, and there's lots of writing on it. You can look up subcultures. Paul Hodgkinson talks about it, Ted Polhemus. There's a lot of people that write on it. So I'm starting to form my own idea.
Oh, yeah.
Based on all my interviews I've done, so.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And I think it's true that we are very much more individualistic, and while we want to align ourselves with a certain idea or aesthetic or group, we're also trying to
distance ourselves from mm-hmm. everyone else already in there and say, like, okay, well, I'm not like them, you know, mm-hmm.
which is interesting.
Yeah. Well, my most recent problem, kind of, not problem, but, like, irritation is, like, health goth, because I've read interviews from, the interviews from the people that created this internet sensation say, oh, well, you can listen to whatever you want. That's not the point of a subculture. A subculture is very connected to the music. Mm-hmm. And when you have no music basis, it is not... You cannot call yourself a goth.
Yeah, it's purely aligned around an aesthetic, which yeah. is really weird.
Which shows the postmodernism idea of being a community but not having that basis of music, which is what subcultures have always been about.
You said that you don't think it exists anymore, goth as we know it. So where do you think goth's influence is going to go from here?
Well, there are goth communities, mm-hmm. and I think those will stay around. People always are attracted to darkness. And there's also old goths now who throw goth parties, and then there's young people who throw goth parties.
But that's mostly nostalgia, right?
A lot of it is. A lot of it is nostalgia, but, I mean, there is a nice little post-punk scene coming up from Berlin and places in Europe, but I think in America it's so hard to really find a scene of like-minded people that don't have all these different angers. Like, everybody's trying to be the best at everything, and in Europe it's a little bit different because they really do like the idea of subcultures, and post-punk is coming up, but maybe it'll hit US, and it's just black, people wearing black with the same aesthetic of music, and I think that's important. But if music isn't involved, then wearing black doesn't make you a goth. I'm sorry. That's what takes me off so bad.
Yeah, I'll be sure to keep it in there, yeah, so everybody knows.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I absolutely agree, and I think I can totally see in 20 years, 40 years, 60 years, 80 years, a goth renaissance coming along where yeah. it won't be the same thing, certainly, but in the same way that, like, the goths of the 80s drew on right. Gothic literature of the Victorian era and earlier.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think it'll be reinvented.
I hope so. I mean, I hope there's new stuff, too. I don't know, I'm an 80s person, but I really hope for more people to create new stuff.
I think it's inevitable.
I hope so.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah.
That's it for this episode of the Morbid Anatomy Transmission. Again, A Desire for Dramaticism has sold out, but you can keep track of Andy's other events at her website, andyharriman.com. That's Andy with an I, by the way. If you're one of the lucky folks with a ticket to her lecture at the museum, she's informed me that there will be copies of her book, Somewhere Leather, Somewhere Lace, on sale there. For those of us without tickets, fortunately, the book is also available on Amazon. Andy also has a weekly DJ set at Bossa Nova Civic Club in Brooklyn called Synthicide, which is billed as a dark dance party. Also, it's free. If you haven't been to a Morbid Anatomy event yet, it's high time you got in there. Coming up in June, we have a three-part series called A Thief's Guide to Alchemy, a tarantula preservation class, and the ever-popular Morbid Anatomy Flea Market. To learn more, go to morbidanatomymuseum.org or email info@morbidanatomymuseum.org. Oh, and please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Thanks! These last words were Emily Dickinson's, who, appropriately poetically, said, "I must go in, for the fog is rising.